Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls at the start of Hell Week. Katie, what is Hell Week other than some strange sort of boot camp for people who like posing outside fitness studios?
Well, Isabel, as you were pointing out before we started recording, there is a chance that whichever minister came up with this title and told the Sunday Times is an avid attendee of Barry's boot camp where Hell Week was previously incarnated. What Hell Week is in this instance is a series of hellish events for Theresa May on Brexit. And that is because we are now getting to the crunch of the crunch. After conference, we knew that Theresa May at conference was planning to sail through it by putting off the difficult decisions. We're now running into the point where we're going to start having those. We have Barnier meeting with Dominic Raab today. Then later in the week, we have Barnier meeting with Arlene Foster. We're expecting to get the UK's backdrop agreements proposals, one that they've been working on. And we might, if we're very lucky in terms of hellish events, get a glimpse of what this draft withdrawal agreement is going to look like. And just to set the scene for that, we already have lots of Brexiteers heavily briefing the papers to say that if there are too many concessions that they don't like, and the full expectation is there will be, then they're ready to, you know, take this war and really start to resort to guerrilla tactics in the Commons.
It's interesting, James, that they're not threatening to actually vote down the final deal. They're threatening to cause trouble on lots of other things, potentially even the budget.
I think the problem with voting down the final deal is no one can look at the government's planning for no deal, which didn't really start with any seriousness until this summer, and think the country's ready for it. I think any politician who voted down the deal would run a risk of A, getting all the blame for what happens. And if you're a Brexiteer, you run two other risks, I'd say. The first is that if the UK left, and then the next few weeks were summed up by total chaos, you can imagine that the European Union will be busy saying, well, you can come back anytime you like, and that there is a danger for Brexiteers that the public say, oh God, it's obviously too difficult to leave. The other danger is no deal is the one circumstance in which I think a second referendum happens. Now, Brexiteers say, no, as soon as Parliament votes to trigger Article 50, it set itself on that course. But just the political reality, I think, means that something that is opposed by 5/6 of the MPs in the House of Commons, and with John Bercow as Speaker of the House of Commons, that there would be some way would be found to throw up an obstacle to allow either a general election or another referendum. So I think those are the risks, and why I thought it was quite interesting that Steve Baker, who obviously is talking his book on the number of rebels, even he admits that the whips will probably take away half of his numbers.
So they're very soft numbers. And it sounds actually, Katie, as though Theresa May is going to have a hectic week rather than a hellish week. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I think with Theresa May, any week can turn hellish for her quite quickly. So you can never rule it out. I mean, one of the things which has been a growing story in recent days is Number 10's attempts to win over Labour MPs. So their charm offensive when it comes to this final deal. And there's the thinking that they have about 20 Labour MPs that might steal them over the line. So even if the Brexiteers, you know, see red, so long as they can limit that, as James says, the numbers will reduce. So they can limit that to around, you know, just around, you know, double figures, but not really much above 20, then there is a chance they'll still be able to get it through. I mean, that is a tactic that obviously annoys a lot of Tory MPs because they say, well, actually, why are you wasting your time trying to win from the other side? You should be trying to win MPs over in your own party. But I think it also hints to the reality, which is just, it's very hard to see any Brexit deal which will win over all sides of the Tory party.
I think there is a certain confusion caused by the labelling here, because people talk about winning over moderate Labour MPs. I don't think that is really Number 10's game, because a lot of moderate Labour MPs are very pro-EU. What it's more about is trying to win over Labour MPs in Leave voting seats who don't want either a second referendum or a general election fought on Brexit. Caroline Flint, Ruth Smith, that kind of crowd are, I think, where they're looking. I'm not saying they've succeeded with, but that's where they'll look, rather than, you know, because Chuckramuna is obviously a moderate, but he's about as likely to vote for Theresa May's Brexit deal as, you know, or even less likely to vote for Theresa May's Brexit deal than Jacob Rees-Mogg or Steve Baker.
And are Labour MPs being receptive to these overtures, Katie? Or, I mean, it's quite difficult for them, isn't it? Because if they're seen to be helping the government, then they get into even more trouble with their local parties. And the mood is quite fractious between parliamentary and local party at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to gauge because obviously you have this scenario where you do think, what Labour opposition party can resist the potential opportunity to become a Labour government and vote down that deal? But I do think what James is correct is if you the plan to basically go with people and leave constituencies is the government's best bet. I remember when I wrote a piece on the People's Vote campaign, and I mentioned the three different parts of their parliamentary plan, so people they wanted to win over. And one of which I pointed out in the piece was rather optimistic, was people like Gareth Snell, people like, you know, Ruth Smith, people like Caroline Flint, people in leave areas with leave constituents. And I did at the time have a few of them get in touch and make very clear they would not go near a second referendum. And I do think these people are the ones who, yes, maybe their local party, but ultimately in their constituency offices, they have to continually meet with constituents who voted leave and are going to be very unhappy if they think the Labour Party and their MP has stopped that from happening.
I think the other thing as well, a general election for these people, that general election would be dominated by Brexit, in that you would have kind of, you know, all the Tories' money would be spent funneling leaflets into those seats saying your MP is part of a plan to stop Brexit. And so it's an interesting question of which they are more afraid of, their constituency, Labour Party, or their broader electorate.
Just sticking with Labour, Katie, John McDonnell has been talking about universal credit.
Yep, so John McDonnell has advanced the Labour position and said that previously on universal credit, the Labour plan was to attack the Tories' handling of it and say the scheme rollout was disastrous, and that Labour had put in the sufficient reforms to make it work. He's now gone a step further, and speaking on Sunday, he said that Labour would just ditch universal credit. I think that'll be fairly popular with the members. What's interesting is in the snap election, one of the things Labour were criticised for was for all their universal big spend policies, you know, abolishing tuition fees, they didn't do much to reverse some of the benefit changes. So I think this might be the Labour Party catching up late to what they need to do on benefit systems, when in general they often seem to be more keen on universal policies.
I think there is a challenge here, which is the rollout of universal credit is immensely technical. And I remember when Esther McVeigh was appointed to that job, you know, this is her first Secretary of State job in the Cabinet, there was a certain intake of breath among some Tories, because it is, and she has always taken quite a hard line on some of these welfare changes. And so there was a slight element of surprise there. I think the danger of universal credit is you can't have families who are living close to the poverty line losing £200. It just doesn't work like that. So that's the challenge, to get the rollout delivered in such a way that you don't have people suddenly... I mean, the whole point of the system is that people aren't meant to drop off cliff edges anymore. So if you still got people dropping off cliff edges, it's obviously got problems.
Do you think Whitehall and Westminster have actually got a handle on this? Or is it one of those policies where everyone's going to say it's fine until it manifestly is not fine? Or is it already manifestly not fine and everyone's in denial?
I think it's quite interesting that when Philip Hammond at Cabinet a few weeks back was talking kind of very, I can't remember the word he used, I'm a story about it, so I should be able to remember the word he used, but basically very pejoratively about complaints about universal credit. And those who people who defend him say he was talking specifically about how the Labour front bench were talking about it, but I think the word was squealing. He was talking about how the Labour front bench talk about it. The chief whip was the person who kind of pulled him up and said, don't use that language. And what's interesting is one of the chief whip's cabinet colleagues' point to me was, the chief whip knows just how many Tory MPs are getting really worried about universal credit, and knows that, you know, they've got to be careful about their language, because this is not the concern about universal credit. This is not something restricted to a kind of Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell wing of politics. The actual implementation of it is something that is worrying a lot of Tory MPs too.
And finally, housing. We've got some proposals coming out this week from Onward, which is one of the Tory think tanks, to help people buy their own homes.
Yes, so this is a proposal which is already being tipped could be picked up by the Chancellor for the budget, partly because the man behind it is Will Turner, who formerly did policy for Number 10 before he left to do the venture. And this is probably what you could call a help to buy for renters. So it's the idea that you would incentivise landlords to sell to their tenants if they want to sell the property, because they would get tax relief on capital gains. And it would also mean that the renters were able to buy it would enjoy a discount, so a reduced price. So it's one thing. And I mean, so far it's been quite warmly received, I think, by landlords who have been very sceptical. And we know the government were considering other ways to improve renters' lives, one of which being three-year tenancies. And I think that spooked Number 10, the negative response that idea got from landlords.
James, do you think that this is something that ministers will want to take up?
Well, the big Tory challenge is not just to get more houses built, It's to increase home ownership levels. And I think that the extent you hear a bit of grumbling about the big conference speech announcement allowing local councils to borrow as much as they want to build housing is, that'll be used to build social housing. And in both philosophical and electoral terms, what the Tories need is people to be owner-occupiers. And so anything that advances that agenda, I think, will be popular in Tory circles.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. You can listen to this podcast and all our other podcasts on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. You can also get a special subscription offer for podcast listeners, which is 12 issues of The Spectator for £12 and a free thermally insulated Spectator branded water bottle. Just go to spectator.co.uk/water. Thanks for listening.